This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on Thursday, November 13th, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
All right, next up, we have some audits. First is the report from the Audit Division on Edwards for President. I believe it's 2004 run. Okay. Mr. Faven, how are you?
Good, very good. Good afternoon, I'm Marty Faven. This is Erica Lee. It's my pleasure to present to you the report of the Audit Division on Edwards for President, 2004 Principal Campaign Committee for Senator John Edwards, a candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination for the office of president. The audit resulted in the following findings: net outstanding campaign obligations, receipt of contributions that exceed the limits, receipt of in-kind contributions that exceed the limits, transfer of apparent ineligible funds from Edwards for Senate, and stale dated checks. And we'll be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Got a bunch of objections on this one. Would you like to lead it off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern was with respect to finding four. With respect to the funds that were eligible for transfer. It's a narrow issue. There were several types of funds that were deemed ineligible for transfer. My concern is with, in particular, the funds received from the sale of the committee's assets, the Senate committee's assets to the presidential campaign. My concern is that I don't find in the transfer regs any limits on funds to be made up of contributions only. Here the Senate campaign sold assets to the presidential campaign, I believe in February of the year prior to the year of the transfer, which happened I believe in September. The funds received from the sale were in the Senate campaign as the date of the transfer, and I see no basis on which to exclude them from the sale of the assets. I think importantly the regs do require some scrutiny with respect to the contributions that are being transferred to ensure that the transfer of contributions doesn't result in any excessive transfers, but I don't see any similar basis on which to look at any other funds that might be eligible. So my perspective would be that funds should be broader than just contributions, and in particular in this case, because I note that the response from the committee to the preliminary audit report, you know, noted that had the assets been transferred at a later date, at which point the Senate committee would have been, defunct is the wrong word, would have been closed because the senator had declared that he was no longer seeking that candidacy for the Senate, they could have transferred those assets to the presidential campaign. So the fact that the presidential campaign winds up with both the hard assets like computers and their money back as a result of the transfer of those proceeds doesn't concern me. I agree that there may remain an issue with respect to the payments received for shared space or rent or those sorts of things. That money may need to be segregated out. But my concern is that this approach that's taken in this audit report wouldn't distinguish between this case where the assets were sold to a related campaign and if they had been sold to an unrelated entity. If the Senate campaign had decided to put these assets up on eBay and sold them, those funds would have been a part of the campaign, and this approach, which looks only at contributions, wouldn't allow for those assets to be transferred as well. So those are my concerns with that approach in with respect to the funds available for the transfer.
Okay.
Answer you want us all to sort of talk and
go ahead.
It's whatever you prefer, really. I have a similar concern, but my concerns actually go beyond that. Basically, three areas. First is more of a general issue of process, which is really beyond scope of what team audit does. So this is not really directed at anyone in particular, but it is illustrated by like what Commissioner Bowerly just said, and that a lot of audit reports, particularly this one, turns on predicate legal issues. Sometimes they're cases of first impression, sometimes they're novel, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're straightforward, sometimes they're complex, sometimes they're simple. But ultimately, those who get audited, it's always struck me as odd that the commission does these audits and the recipient of the audit, in this case, the Edwards for President Committee, doesn't really get a chance to also present in this sort of thing. This has come up before I get to the commission, will probably come up again. But as a matter of process, this is an example of something that maybe we could, at some point, allow a little more of an opportunity to be heard, particularly in cases like this where it's legal issues. And this is not an easy legal issue. And having read the sort of narrative responses provided by the Edwards for President campaign, it certainly only made it more complicated, not more straightforward. Here you have a variety of legal theories, I think, that could apply to this to finding four. First, and they each would have really dramatically different results. There's the one in the audit report itself, which really looks at it as a net debt rule. And as I understand it, the senator had debt from his 98 race, which was owed to himself personally. He then raised debt retirement money, retired that debt essentially, and then forgave the debt to himself and took that money, essentially transferred to his presidential run.
Right.
Each individual link in that chain is, I think, perfectly legal, assuming you buy into the assumption before you transfer the money, the assumption being it was actually excess campaign funds. And that's really the issue, is once you do the debt retirement, must you repay that debt back again? Well, he could or he couldn't, I guess. I think what's odd is it's debt to himself, so he could repay the debt to himself and then take the money and put it right back into his presidential campaign, which brings me to the second legal theory, which really isn't addressed in the audit. He could do that, but for the fact he took matching funds, right? He's limited to 50 grand self-funding in that, so this was a way to sort of get the money into the presidential campaign before hitting the $50,000 threshold. And that's a legal issue that really hasn't, I don't think, been fleshed out. Third issue is the one Commissioner Bowerly raises, where, you know, is it, can we use just contributions, or is it contributions plus other monies raised by the campaign for selling off assets or whatnot? I don't see a good reason why that's not a viable legal theory. And I'm stating that in the negative, which will become clear in a minute, but generally, all these legal theories, I can't find any real clear precedent for applying one over the other. And I think as a campaign, I sympathize Edwards for President's predicament, that they saw a way to move money, and they did, and there's really nothing in the regs, I think, that clearly prohibits what they did. But there is 110.3C43, which is the kind of the transfer reg that seems to be much more specific than the theory advanced in the audit. So that's an elaborate way of asking, I think, a very broad question. And that is, how do we, when going through audits, decide the predicate legal theory? And when there's alternative theories, when's the judgment made and that kind of thing? I think Commissioner Bowerly makes some good points on her theory, but it's just one of, I think, several theories that lead to either Edwards having done nothing wrong or done a lot of things wrong. And I don't see a clear path that one really trumps the other necessarily. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And of course, that's why we get a legal analysis done and to see which you know, which one to apply in each particular situation. Wanda, do you have anything? Or?
Well, usually it's based on prior experience, and as Marty said, we get a legal opinion about it before we send something up. And it's usually based on us reviewing sometimes the E&J and to see how the same principles were applied in a previous audit.
Has this issue come up before in previous audit?
This one's fairly unique as far as my experience. I don't think we've really seen anything quite like this one. Joe?
I think that's correct. We haven't seen this issue a lot in audits. Certainly not with the complexity that goes with this one. And, you know, as Wanda said, you know, we read the regs, we read the past precedent. We and counsel spent more than a little time together before we did the analysis trying to agree on what the best approach was, and out of all that came what you have before you.
So is it, do I take it then that the analysis, the legal analysis in the audit report is consistent with what general counsel?
Yes, that's correct.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say, Mr. Chairman, I think what we've said in the analysis, which is at the back of the final audit report, is that it's an open question whether you should look at funds or merely contributions. And in response to that, our colleagues in the audit division produced the cover memo of this report, which looked at it. We did suggest in our comments the commission should consider alternatives, and our colleagues in the audit division ran the numbers looking at all funds rather than just contributions. And when you look at all funds, you then have to make a determination whether you're going to exclude the amount that could arguably result in an excessive contribution from the presidential and Senate committee, the asset sale portion, or whether you're going to just exclude all of the other recently received funds. And as you noted, Mr. Chairman, you get some pretty different results depending on which of those paths you go down. I would just say as well, in terms of the process and in connection with the question of the excess campaign funds, that while a number of you are seeing this for the first time and the public is seeing this for the first time at the final audit report stage, some of these issues, and that was one in particular, we spent a fair amount of time, not just between ourselves and the audit division, but the commission did as well at the interim audit report stage.
That's helpful. Unfortunately, though, for Edwards for president, that what the public sees for the first time is the recommended final audit report.
But Edwards for president does get to see the interim audit report and respond to it.
That is true. And they disagreed with that quite strenuously, as I recall. The real problem I have with finding four is although it feels like something that should be a problem, and probably something if I were, although I obviously wasn't, you know, an attorney scrubbing this, I probably would have given me some pause. Doesn't necessarily mean I would have said no, but it certainly, to me, that raises the issue of, well, how can we now, particularly in an audit, which essentially declares they violated the law, say they did so when it's not entirely clear to me that it was a clear illegal course that they took to move the money. I kind of understand the argument, but it kind of bootstraps a couple of concepts together. I'm struggling with why the Edwards for President folks would know this was illegal at the time they did what they did. That's for anybody. You don't have a past audit that says this is not a good idea. We don't have a past MER that says it's a bad idea, right? We don't have an AO. We don't have a reg. What do we have? We have, for the future, maybe it should be a bad idea, but when they did it, I don't see on the books that it was a bad idea.
Chairman, I think you have a good point with respect to, I think there are some concepts that has to be strung together. But I think the fact remains that they are there. And when you look at the fact that the regulation actually used the terms funds received, and in our analysis, we agree that we don't think that is limited to contributions. And then when you open it up, I mean, there are other things that should be considered. Mm-hmm. And so we agree with that as well. But when you get to the point of those other things, I think there may be a problem when you look at the assets that were sold. Because in fact, if for example, this transaction had occurred one day, then the next day, whereas they sold the assets, and the next day they turn around and transfer the money, I think we would look at it with a more suspicious eye. And I think the reason that it may not appear as a violation to us because there is a period of time in between the two transactions. But bottom line, I think.
I'm not quite following you. If it happened, if the timing was different,
right?
Could you elaborate on why that matters?
If the timing was different, I think we would look at it with a more suspicious eye because we were saying, well, maybe they were trying to make a contribution to the presidential committee.
Oh, I see. Yes. Someone buying the goods,
yes,
or whatnot. It would look,
right,
like backdooring. Okay, got
exactly.
It. I understand that. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think we're talking about two. Really, there's two major issues that you mentioned. One is the 98 debt retirement money. And while there may not be something that says on its four corners that you can't do this, the principle that we're trying to vindicate here is that we do have a reg that says you can't raise debt retirement money if you don't have any debt. So it's not a big leap from that to say that there is some restriction on the use of those particular funds, that you got to pay those, you got to use those funds to pay that debt. And if somebody waves a wand and that debt doesn't exist anymore, it's sort of like when you have raised general election funds and don't make the general election, you got to give that money back. On the other issue, the issue of the asset sale, the committee did argue pretty vociferously in response to the preliminary audit report that the calculation ought to be funds rather than just contributions. And again, there are two ways you can go if you accept their argument on that, and one of them actually puts them in a worse position than they otherwise would be in. And our colleagues in the audit division can elaborate on that.
Yeah, that is correct. If we consider all the funds transferable, the amount does favor the committee. But if the sale of assets is not allowed by the commission, then they end up in a worse position than they were before.
Just so I can track it, and forgive me, I'm getting over a cold, so I'm on cold medicine, so I have to slow it down a little bit today. So how does that square with Commissioner Bowerly's concerns?
Well, Commissioner Bowerly, her position was not to disallow the sale of assets, so it ends up with the committee in a better position.
Okay. That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure. What's the legal argument again against doing it that way?
Well, the situation has to do with whether there's an in-kind contribution of returning the assets or returning the money.
At the point, sure.
Mr. Chairman, if I might elaborate on that a little bit, One of the things the regulation does tell us fairly clearly is when you transfer money, it's the most recent money that you receive that is transferred, and that can't cause a limitation problem. In this case, the most recent, or some of the most recent money received, was in fact the payment from the Presidential Committee to the Senatorial Committee for shared expenses and assets purchased. Now, those same assets couldn't be just moved without making an in-kind contribution. So the Presidential Committee correctly paid the Senatorial Committee. If the Senatorial Committee can then, working back through its most recent receipts, turn around and give the money back, you know, do we then have a contribution from one to the other that was avoided by the payment in the first place? And that's the theory in the cover memo that concludes that including funds, the broader definition, but excluding those asset purchases actually puts the committee in a worse position than if we just look at contributions.
Still hung up on the basic issue, though, that it seems that the rules were, to be kind, less than clear. It seems like the campaign saw some daylight and they took advantage of it. I don't think there's any doubt about that. How to move money from the Senate campaign over to the presidential campaign, retiring the debt, that kind of thing. But. This is someone mentioned this earlier. I didn't want to cut anybody off, but when they raised the debt retirement money, there was debt at the time that they raised the money, right? So they had debt, they raised debt retirement money. So the question is, do you then have to take that money and pay off the debt, or can you then forgive the debt? And what's unique about this case, it's a self-funding debt issue, which kind of raises our old friend Buckley, and you know, you have a right to give your money and all that kind of thing. Bicker has changed that to a certain extent. Not Buckley, obviously, but the amount which you can loan your campaign and get paid back. That's not impacted here, though, right? There's no statutory limit on how much he could put into his campaign and pay himself back here, right? This is pre-Bicker. Right, okay. So I'm still hung up on something that
Mr. Chairman,
seems fishy, but I can't put my finger on why it's actually illegal, at least why this commission's already said it's illegal before these folks acted.
One thing that may help with this is that in the net debt rule, when it talks about raising contributions after the fact to pay off debt from your campaign, I believe the rule goes on to say as you decrease the amount of your debt, you can't raise any more money. And that seems to suggest that when you no longer have the debt, you're not supposed to be raising any money to do something else with it. Mm-hmm. And so at least that theory about as you begin to decrease the amount, you're supposed to limit that to actually, you're supposed to limit the amount you can solicit to what you actually have left. So that seems to suggest when you totally eliminate your debt, that you're not supposed to do something else with the money that you've raised.
Sort of. But it also could suggest another thing, which is you just can't keep raising debt retirement money.
Right.
It has to relate back to the,
exactly,
to debt. You don't get to keep raising, you know, if you have $100,000 worth of debt, you can't keep raising money saying we still have debt.
Right.
It reduces the debt. But then it's a step in the analysis beyond that, right? Because then there was debt, he did raise money consistent with that rule.
Right.
And then after that rule kind of ceased applying, and if from one point of view, he then forgave the debt, which you can forgive debt. You see, each separate step in this is fine on its own. It's when you sort of bootstrap it together, all of a sudden it looks kind of funny. But looking funny and being funny are two different things, I think. But those are my thoughts on that. That's where I'm struggling on finding four, and that's why I'm not I'm having trouble supporting it because of the lack of clarity in the rule. Now, maybe this is something that, I don't know if there's a way we announce from here on out this is something we can't do, but it just doesn't seem fair to the Edwards folks to say after the fact you can't do this after they did it. When I can sort of connect the dots and say I can sort of see what they were doing. Simply because it seems kind of funny, like I said, doesn't make it illegal. Certainly creative. But creative is not legally problematic unless it already is legally problematic. Mr. Weintraub?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't know whether you'll find this informative, persuasive, or anything else, but I just wanted to make sure that we were, in response to your previous question about how, it's not illegal for him to put his own resources into his own campaign. That's true for the Senate campaign. It wouldn't be true for his presidential campaign because that was publicly funded.
And so right. I mentioned that at the $50,000 limit, yeah. which is, but that's not explored in the audit. Well, you could another analysis is he raises debt retirement money, okay? He could, instead of forgiving the debt, okay, the senator could have just paid himself back this dollar amount. He could turn around and put it into a subsequent campaign. The problem is if he puts in this amount of money in a subsequent campaign, he blows through the $50,000 cap, right, takes him out of the matching funds regime.
Right.
But we're not really talking about that issue, I don't think. That doesn't seem to be fleshed out in the audit. I'm kind of wondering why. I raised it, my initial, different legal theories that could apply to that. And if that legal theory gets applied, the campaign really has got a problem. Because then I guess they have to repay the entire matching funds amount. So why haven't we gone down that road?
Well, part of the theory was actually raised and discussed at the preliminary audit report stage. We discussed some of those theories. About the impact on the $50,000 expenditure limitation for the candidate. So it's something that we have talked about, and we have explored. It was something that we did at the preliminary audit report stage.
Okay.
So it was a theory that we explored.
Okay. So this has been a discussion before I got here that enough people said no, that's not, that dog doesn't hunt here. We'll get to find another theory. Any other thoughts on finding four? If not, I'd like to actually ask a couple questions about another finding. This is the excessive contribution finding, which is finding two. Thank you. Thank you very much. People go two. Really a couple questions about sampling. And I think the final audit report makes clear that the dollar amount of issue is not really a metaphysically accurate number. It's based upon a projection, which I think is the proper way to say this. You don't want to necessarily say that he has $200,000 of excessive when it's really just a statistical model. And I think for audit purposes, I think that's fine. I'd have trouble imposing a penalty necessarily based upon a statistical model, but for purposes of the audit, I think it's fine. But I want to get a sense a little bit about the methodology, because I know that the Edwards campaign raised some issues with the audit, and it doesn't seem to be a frontal attack on the methodology. So I understand that this is the methodology that's used with respect to obtaining matching funds and that kind of thing. It's a pretty good methodology. Folks who maybe have challenged it here and there over the years and all have failed to poke holes in it. It's a fair assessment.
That's correct, and it's also not a methodology that we developed ourselves. I mean, it's a methodology that's widely used in the auditing accounting world. In fact, the basic algebra underlying it comes out of a textbook that was published by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants some years ago. And so it is a sound methodology. Now, the committee disagrees in a lot of areas with what we consider or defined as an exception when we were evaluating the sample. Mm-hmm. That's not the same thing as challenging the technique itself.
They're dealing more with the garbage in, garbage out attack. They're not really attacking the processing of the garbage. They're saying some of the contributions in the sample are not,
or shouldn't be considered,
shouldn't be in the sample as a problematic.
At one point, they do suggest that you know, after they're done expressing their opinion on all of the transactions that were considered exceptions, there's only three left, and that's not a valid sample. Well, the sample wasn't three. The sample was more like 650. With what they object to is only having three exceptions left in the sample. There's no minimum number of exceptions for it to be an accurate sample. As a matter of fact, this particular sampling technique is especially well suited for small error rate populations. That's its sort of specialty.
So, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thanks. I just had a question since we're right on that. So that 650 samples out of 81,000 total, say that's 8% of just calculating it out. Do you decide that in advance? Okay, we need at least 8%, we need 10%, we need 2%. Do you base it on, okay, we got 81,000 here, we can't do them all? But how do you arrive at what's a representative sample?
There is a computer program that has calculations in it that at least gives you a good starting point. There are really three things that impact sample size. And as counterintuitive as it may seem, the size of the population isn't one of them. The reliability of that you want to achieve, and you know, we all see polls that said 95% reliability will do the same thing. The sampling error that you're willing to tolerate, that's the plus or minus that we all see when a poll is published. And the one that is probably most significant is the number of exceptions that you find in the sample. So what you have to do is you start out estimating what that's going to be. You run through the initial sample, you evaluate, see how you did. If the number of exceptions was higher than you had anticipated, then you have to go back and draw more sample items in order to get the reliability and sampling error that you were aiming for. So it can be an iterative process depending on the results.
In this case, how did the percentage come about?
It was how many items we needed with the number of errors that were observed to achieve 95% reliability with the specified tolerable sampling error. And then again, the computer programs that do the algebra let us know how we how we're doing. Yeah.
I think the Edwards Committee talks about the 12 excessives in the sample, and they get down to three. I'm not being a statistician. I'm getting kind of fuzzy on where those numbers come from.
We had initially 12 exceptions. Three of them they accept. The others they argue with. So there
12
are
exceptions mean 12 excessive contributions.
In okay. The sample.
All right. And they're saying nine are not really excessive?
That's correct.
Why do they say that?
Eric can probably do a better job on that than I can.
They actually received late signed reattribution letters, and for those, they say that although the letters were received late, the intent was there was correct, and so they reattributed them correctly. And then they also say because for the they received credit card contributions as well as check contributions. For the credit card contributions, they state that what remains from the credit card contributions that they did not receive signed reattribution letters, they say should be removed from the sample. We should remove all credit card contributions. So it gets down to the three contributions that they acknowledge are excessive.
So the projection is just based on three contributions?
The projection is not based on three contributions. The original projection is based on the 12 contributions.
Okay. All right.
But they acknowledge there are, they say there are three.
That are a problem. They agree that they have at least three found that are problems. Okay. So when you do the projection, you come up with the $239,538 number. That's not the number, right? It's probably a range. When you do a projection, you're probably going to have a high number and a low number. It's probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, okay. It's the midpoint.
Okay. Any sense of what the range is? You wouldn't know, would you? So just so you know where I'm going with it, if the Edwards Committee is right that nine of the results were actually permissible contributions for whatever reason, they did a redesignation letter that was maybe not within 60 days but close enough or consistent with what we may have done in some other case, how would that affect the projection? That would probably skew it. That would move the number down significantly.
Absolutely, we would do a new projection based on whatever the number turned out to be.
Okay.
And it would certainly be lower.
It, by the way, it would also tighten the range as a result.
Right. This is why I followed up because the right. I understand. Got it.
Would it automatically just be 1/4? Or how do you?
Not necessarily.
It would be more complicated.
Be
I figured that.
The high number is 442,000.
It's almost double the projected middle number. So the low number.
I don't think the lower bound is actually on this information that we have.
Okay.
For some reason, the program doesn't give you that.
The old program.
That's okay. Is it safe to assume that the high number versus the number in the audit report, which is the, would the low number be somewhere proportionate proportionally off of that number?
Yes, you'd hope so.
Yeah, it should be roughly symmetrical.
It would be half that.
So the plus or minus.
So half of 239 is 120. So it could be as low as 120 of excessive, even assuming it's sample, even assuming Edwards' arguments on the integrity of the sample don't carry the day, right? The 239 number could be, because it's ultimately a sample. It could be a lot less than that.
Yes.
Could be a lot less, could be a lot more.
Got it. Now, the recommendation is to pay the 239 to the U.S. Treasury, assuming that's standard kind of operating procedure.
The recommendation is actually to pay a little bit less because we gave them credit for the presumptive letters and any refund they made.
Okay. I see just 154 number.
Right, we're down to 154.
Got it. So that does address in at least some of the arguments the Edwards campaign made with respect to some of the excessive contributions, right? You gave him, even though it wasn't within 60 days, you gave him credit and said close enough. Even if we do that, there's still 100 and some thousand dollars worth of projected problems.
Right. Based on commission decisions in some other cases, the presumptive reattributions were applied as a credit. We gave them another opportunity to go through and compile that for us.
That's all I have for now. Any other thoughts on this sampling? Edwards campaign raise any other issues with any other findings? My recollection was just finding 2 and finding 4.
Basically, 2 and 4.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Thoughts, discussion?
I would just, for just one moment, like to go back to finding 4. First time I read the report, I think, like many of the others, I thought that something seemed a little bit fishy about how this transaction occurred. And then when I went back and actually looked at the regs, it didn't appear to me that the regs actually specifically prohibited what happened in this case. I think that if you wanted to read between the lines, or if you wanted to examine the emanations or the penumbras coming out from the regs, I think that you would say that this sort of transfer was not necessarily contemplated, and maybe was not anticipated or desired, but on the other hand, it's not specifically prohibited. And if it's not specifically prohibited, can we really go after the Edwards campaign for and say that they violated the law and the regulations without having when the actual language of the regulations doesn't appear to specifically prohibit that? So this is more of a comment than a question. We've gone over this ground fairly thoroughly, but I have to agree with the chairman that troubles me as well about this finding, about whether or not we are on solid legal footing to say that this transfer was actually impermissible.
Mr. Schultz.
I wouldn't argue that this particular transaction is not discussed in the regulation, but I think that is something that will always be the case. The commission, I don't think, has or conceivably can write a regulation to specifically cover every combination and permutation of transactions that somebody's going to come up with. I think our regulation book would be many times the size it is now, and we'd still wouldn't cover them all. You know, it was our opinion in this, and especially with respect to the debt retirement money. The regulations are fairly strict about debt retirement money because it goes back to the basic per-election contribution limitation concept, that if you can't continue to raise money for a past election if you don't have bills to pay, because otherwise what you're really doing is raising money for another election and doing it and hence doubling your contribution limitation. Clearly, the regs don't anticipate a case where somebody goes ahead and raises that retirement money and then with the stroke of a pen all the debt's gone. So but I think the principles are fairly well defined. If you're raising money for debt retirement and you overshoot, which can happen if you're lucky, you have to either give it back or go back to the contributor and say, I'd like to use it for something else. And if the contributor says fine, then that's fine too. In this case, you know, they overshot because the candidate was able to make the debt disappear. But he had all this debt retirement money, which is now raised for a past election for which there is no debt. So it seemed to us fairly, it was clear to us anyway, let's put it that way, it was clear to us that the intent of the regulation would be to say, okay, well, that may be fine. It's within your right to forgive the debt. It was within your right to raise money for the debt when it was there. But now that you've done both and then forgiven the debt, you either need to give the money back or go back to the contributor and say, can I use it for the presidential? And if the contributor says yes, fine, move it over. But the contribution limit for the presidential is then consumed by this. Surplus funds tend to be cases where there was more money than obligations on hand on the day of the election. I don't know if there's anywhere in the regulations where you can raise surplus campaign funds after the election. I think that's a concept that's pretty clear. So though I certainly agree that we don't have a regulation that specifically says if you didn't raise that retirement money and then the debt disappears for whatever reason, you have to do this. The concepts embodied in regulation, I think, cover it fairly well. And that's obviously why we made a recommendation we did. And I think council agreed that the necessary concepts are there to provide guidance and to allow us to say you couldn't do this.
I tend to support that analysis because we can't just look at the fact that okay, you have extra money and now you can do whatever you want with it, but the donor has something to say about it too, and the donor may be willing to give money to help somebody out who found themselves really going to the nth degree and needed the money, and then all of a sudden finds out that extra money that you gave, and maybe there's a donor that gave earlier, maybe it's not. Even if it's not, that may be even worse because this person probably had some pressure put on them to contribute to because there was a debt, and then automatically it's gone, and no the reason, the principal reason for that person for that campaign is no longer there. So I, and especially if the person lost, or and I'm thinking just generically, then what do you do when you to the donor's intent, which I think is always needs to be kept in mind. So for me, it's not a stretch to adopt the analysis that the audit division uses here.
The other way to look at this is one of the things we explored at the preliminary audit report is to look at this as actually as a triangle. And one end of the triangle is the candidate, another end, the Senate committee, another end, the presidential committee. But the important thing about this triangle is that the candidate is in control of all three. Of course, he's in control of himself, he's in control of the Senate committee, and he's in control of the presidential committee. And then he can sit and eliminate a debt and move money where he could not have moved money initially himself. So I think that's important. It's just a different way to look at this.
Picking up on the vice chair's concern on contributor intent. Many times people will give it to a campaign and the campaign won't spend the money. It'll become excess campaign funds and then be transferred off to a party committee or something that contributors wouldn't necessarily maybe like. But that kind of oversimplifies it. I think the vice chair makes a good point, but I'm curious if the folks who gave to the debt retirement also gave, if we know, to the presidential campaign. Was there double dipping here? Did the folks kind of max out for the debt retirement and turn around and also write checks to the presidential campaign? Because that really gets at your kind of thing. If they didn't double dip, they could have just written a check to the presidential campaign, the whole issue, the debt issue.
We didn't really look at that part of it as part of our analysis.
Just to kind of move it along, I'm still hung up on finding four, and not sure what we can do about that at this stage. Our Commissioner Peterson also said he's hung up on finding four. The vice chair thinks it's okay. Any sense of where everyone else is on finding four? Your original concern, is that still out there? I think it would be.
Yes, but I agree with the vice chair with respect to the debt retirement. I do think the rules with respect to how you raise and spend debt retirement are pretty clear. I don't have any problem with the finding, the conclusion in the audit report with respect to that. My concern was limited to the exclusion of other monies from the definition of from the funds.
Could that retirement money ever become excess campaign funds? Assuming we adopt this finding, or are we adopting a rule where essentially any debt retirement money is never going to end up becoming excess funds?
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer is no. The principle here is that debt retirement money, like money raised for a general election when you never participate in the general election, can't become excess campaign funds. It's if the debt no longer exists, it would then have to be returned to the contributor or duly reattributed or redesignated.
The difference, though, I think you can distinguish the difference between the situation where you don't make it to the general election, you have to give the money back, versus debt retirement money, which is a contribution limit that relates back to an election in which you did participate. So you're essentially, the law is allowing you to go back after the election and hit up those who hadn't given before the election, but they're still within that same limit. I think I kind of see it as a slightly different concept in my mind than the situation where you lose the primary and you don't never get to the general. As a contribution, the other contribution limit would never kick in. Right, so you wouldn't have the ability to raise the extra money for a general because you're never in the general. In this case, you were in the elections. The contribution limit applies. But I understand the point. I'm not sure it's as tight a fit as it needs to be. Yes.
But debt retirement money is money that you're raising at a time when you normally would be banned from raising that money because it's after the election. Normally you can't raise money after the election. This is an exception to that rule that allows you to raise money after the election, but only for this limited purpose of retiring the debt. So if you don't have debt, you couldn't have raised the money in the first place.
Right, but when he raised the money, he had debt. It was this chicken and the egg, we keep going around. And then after he raised the money, then he said, we're gonna forgive the debt. So there was debt at the time he raised it.
And of course it was, he gets to decide whether he has debt or not, because the debt is to him.
Right.
Which makes it even trickier.
Right, which is why, this is why I'm hung up. It's very clever. I'm not so sure now we can punish cleverness after the fact when it wasn't clear such cleverness was illegal at the time. But yes, no. I thought you were going to. No.
Okay.
Other thoughts on finding four?
My final thoughts will be that I think that the General Counsel's Office and Audit make a reasonable argument. I think that you could look at, as I think you put it, the concepts or the principles underlying these provisions, and reach the conclusion that is reached in the report. The game of finding legal loopholes and then plugging them up, and then clever lawyers finding new holes, and then I think that little song and dance has been going on as long as there's been law, probably. From the time Moses brought stone tablets down from the mount, I imagine there was someone down there trying to find the loophole, and that is a maneuvering that's going to go on. It's gone on for long before we were here and long after we were here, and so for me personally, it comes down to what in an area where core First Amendment activities are implicated, where is the presumption going to lie? Are we going to presume that? Are we going to give these concepts a more full reading in terms of what we believe are the underlying concepts or principles, or are we going to read them narrowly according to what is actually the wording in the regs? And my approach is generally, again, since these are core First Amendment activities that are being participated in, and since it's according to my reading, I don't think that what specifically was here, even though I think that, again, I think that the underlying principles may say that this shouldn't happen. The actual language of the regs, I don't see as specifically prohibiting, and so that's where I come down on this issue.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I share the concerns articulated by the chairman and by Commissioner Peterson for many of the same reasons that they've discussed. As I said in a previous public meeting, I think it's very important for campaigns, candidates, parties, and others who participate in our political process to have a clear sense of what the rules are before they begin. And because this transaction wasn't patently prohibited, they found a clever way to sort of get around something. I think we all agree with that, but that doesn't mean that it's patently impermissible. And also, as is stated in the audit report, one of my other concerns is stated here, the commission may initiate an enforcement action at a later time with respect to any of the matters discussed in this report. Of course, enforcement actions are not public, and I don't want to speak to anything that's not on the public record, but my understanding is if we find that this transfer was not appropriate, that may then appear in a different context, and I think of proving that finding could come up again in the future, possibly. Thank you.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somebody's looking for loopholes in the First Amendment. They're going to have to answer to a higher authority than us, and the penalties will probably be commensurately more severe than anything we could impose. It's not really a revolutionary notion that one would read regulations in light of the intent behind them and behind the statute. I think that Mr. Stoltz made a good point. We couldn't possibly write our the regulations are fat enough as they are. It's already a pretty hefty book. The we couldn't possibly write to prevent every conceivable clever way around the rules that somebody might think of down the road. And I just don't have a problem with looking at the regs, and there's a longstanding principle in the law that you know, this commission has approved on various occasions, that you don't let people do something indirectly that they couldn't do directly. Seems to me that's, if we reject the finding on the debt retirement, that's pretty much where we're going. But I'm comfortable with the debt retirement conclusion of the audit report as is. It doesn't look like there will be 4 votes for it, but just wanted to make my views known.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair.
I wonder if I, maybe to get the ball off, I'll move approval of the audit report, and then I know some or all will be carved away, but I think probably now we've all had a say and we can see what we can come up with.
Okay, so motion is to adopt the final audit report. All in favor, say aye.
I'll say aye. I assume to be an amendment to it, but
I thought the intent was just to see, just take the audit report as is, vote on that first. And sorry, I missed.
Either way, it works. Then somebody's gonna have to make another motion. So.
Oh. Okay.
However.
Got it.
If it's gonna be,
instead of doing a series of motions.
No compromise, then we might as well just get it on now.
I'd like to move that we adopt the audit report with one slight modification to the inclusion of all funds, not limited to the contributions. I've previously explained.
That's a substitute motion.
Yes, I apologize. That's a substitute motion.
Okay. Does that affect the numbers in the audit report?
Yeah.
Yes, it does. It would lower the amount by around $69,000 for the first transfer.
Okay. So I assume the motion would include also adjusting the numbers accordingly.
Yes.
So procedurally, I mean, it would be an amendment to substitute entirely, and I would accept that as a friendly amendment. I think that's the way we are, unless you vote the first one down.
I think you can make, I'll defer to council, but I think that a commissioner can make a substitute motion.
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
Yep, directive 10. Paragraph on this. So on the substitute motion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No.
Okay, that deadlocks 3-3. So now we could have another motion maybe. Without finding 4, we do one finding at a time, or you know, whatever you think moves it along.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would like to move for the adoption of the Edwards Audit Report Agenda Document Number 08-34, subject to removing the finding 4.
Okay, so the motion is for the top of the audit report without finding 4. All in favor, say aye.
Mr. Chairman, if
yes.
I might.
Go ahead.
What the commission tradition does with audit findings that aren't approved is they remain, and there's an explanation of the commission's action on them, and it helps lay out for the regulated community a little better what the commission's interpretations of these issues are. So what would happen is finding 4 would be revised to explain that the commission was unable to reach a conclusion on on the issue.
Do we would first need to have a vote on that, the reg?
We would, okay. But I thought your motion said to remove finding
okay.
four.
Okay. Then I would modify my motion to, how has that been done in the past, if I might inquire? Is it to disapprove? Approve of the report with the exception of finding four, or what's how should I properly couch this motion?
It's actually, I think it's been done a number of ways in the past, and Mr. Stoltz and Mr. Holloway can help me out here, but I believe there have been instances where the commission has voted to approve the other findings and to receive the finding that didn't get majority support, which sort of indicates that there was less than total agreement with that finding. There have been instances where the report has been returned to the audit division for the addition of further language on the finding to explain the commission's action, whether it was a majority action or a split. There have been instances where the report has been held over and commissioners themselves have come up with language to that effect where each side explained their particular action. I don't think that's happened very often, but I believe it happened in the Bush and Kerry audit reports, and there may be some other options that I'm not thinking about.
So Commissioner Peterson's motion, as is, though, is something that's consistent with what's happened before here and there. There's different ways of doing this. We could strike the finding completely. We could do this accept it, which is a rather new, within the past 10 years, new approach where the finding stays, but then it notes that the commission was unable to adopt it. Concern I have with that approach is, at the end of the day, the distinction between whether it's the audit division's report or the commission's report, I think, gets lost outside of the building. After all, it's on, you know, it's on the commission letterhead. So I think when you accept the finding, I don't think anyone really, my sense is that that's not quite the distinction that Commissioner Peterson is looking for, because I think it still looks like it's part of the audit report. But I'll let him speak for himself on the point.
Would it be more appropriate to couch the motion as approving particular findings, approving 1, 2, 3 and 5, without saying that we are removing finding 4, and then if
with the understanding that we would revise finding 4 to reflect that the commission was unable to reach agreement on the issues presented therein.
So that would work, assuming that's the way the vote goes.
Okay. Then
can I ask a question about that? What's the significance of keeping finding 4 in there if there's not sufficient votes to adopt it?
First of all, it is the way the commission has operated these past 30 years, so that the report as presented, it becomes part of the record, and the commission's decisions with respect to those findings are reflected on the public record. It does provide the regulated community guidance in the future. If it just disappears, then you know, the people in this room know, and anybody who happens to see the agenda item knows, but anybody reading the report later wouldn't even realize that the issue was raised or what the resolution was.
But am I correct? I mean, obviously the report that we're talking about right now is a public document.
It is.
Okay.
It is. It will be an agenda document. The official report that is released, placed on the commission's website as the audit report, would not be this version. It would be the amended version.
But the public would have access to this document, obviously, because it is a public document. So if one were interested, they could go back and I'm not sure if the interim report is public. I think it's
not.
Okay, so they would see this report presented by the audit division and the one that was adopted by the commission in a public meeting. Correct?
It would. If the finding just disappears, then anybody looking at our website and and reading an audit report to see what the issues were, is not going to know to go look for an old agenda item. However, if the finding stays and the resolution of the finding is presented, whether the commission adopts it or they don't adopt it, then that information is out there in the place where people would tend to look for it.
And so the purpose of that is so the public knows that the audit division found this, but the commission didn't agree with it.
Yes.
Is that the
And
purpose?
That provides guidance for people in the future.
Can I, why does that, maybe I can take a stab at this. Of course, we wrestled with this, obviously, before. And what the commission decided before in similar situations where there was a 3-3 split was that if you just take it out, then if somebody was looking for, you know, what does the commission think on the issue of debt retirement, they wouldn't find it. You know, it just would be gone, missing. I mean, yes, if somebody was very industrious, they might say, well, gee, maybe what the final report was wasn't the whole story, and I could go back and look through all the agenda documents, but and the chairman probably would have done that, but a lot of folks out in private practice might not be quite that industrious. So what the commission decided in the past would be more helpful to the regulated community would be to show them that, in fact, this issue was raised, it was discussed, and there was not support on the commission to adopt the recommendation that the auditors made. And that provides more guidance than people sitting out there scratching their heads saying, gee, I wonder if this issue's ever come up before.
That makes a lot of sense, that the fact that it was raised and when the commission took some action on the issue, and I think that's good for public notice. Concern I have, though, is could someone then take this and later say that the FEC auditors found that Senator Edwards, you know, transferred illegal money and split the difference? That's always been my concern, is that someone takes the paragraph and then runs out and says, well, the FEC auditor, and they just completely blur the legal distinction to whether or not we adopted it. It's a true statement that the FEC auditors, you know, made a finding, but it doesn't really, it's not really a fair characterization of what we do, but it ends up being done. I mean, I'm thinking someone runs a, you know, an issue ad someday and says, you know, they found, it's a true statement that there was a, you know, the auditors found something.
I think we can probably, in the amended audit report, draft around that issue. I'm looking to Mr. Stoltz for, you know, if it's drafted carefully, I think we can get around that problem.
That's my concern.
Yeah. Just, no, and,
that
and
comes
I
up.
That,
we've done that in the past.
Okay.
I would actually think that the concern you're raising would be more problematic because this is an agenda document and it is out there. And then if the final report says nothing, then there's nothing for someone to refute that. The final audit report is the conclusion of the commission. If it says the commission couldn't reach a result on that, it seems to me that's much more useful for someone trying to refute an attempt to manipulate what the agenda document says, because that's out there already. That's a public document. There's no pulling this back. So if the final audit report needs to be amended to state whatever the state of this consensus or lack of consensus is, it can do that. But it seems to me that's far better evidence for someone worrying about an ad about an audit finding.
Don't we have any more AOs? I mean, we were doing better on the AO.
There's a couple more. They're not quite ready to go. I think they'll be good. We can do some.
All right.
The Libertarian Party once we recognize that kind of stuff. We're good at those.
Yeah, we can agree on that.
I think one of the things we went through before, and I remember the debate back and forth on that, was a concern on the part of some of the commissioners, and not all, that the audit is an independent function, and that at least the position of the auditors could be known, and it wouldn't be buried because of commission action in some hard-to-find place, but that at least the matter in the auditors being independent would be become known, and the position taken by the commission would become known for better or for worse, and at least that independent role would be recognized.
I think
it's an argument that we made before on another matter that was hotly debated in the first term here.
It adds to the transparency, too, of the commission's operation.
That makes sense. I agree the auditors do have their own division, but they still are Federal Election Commission auditors. They're no longer over GAO. You know, they are. So it's not like we have a separate entity doing an audit. I mean, it's still our audit. I still have the concern, though, that people twist these down the road into strange directions where they make much of an audit finding, even if it was rejected. But I think Commissioner Weintraub is probably on the money, that we could probably write it in a way that pads that up a little bit and makes it clear that this isn't the commission. Did not get the support of the commission in some form, is it four votes or however we phrase it, but something that would address the concern, I think.
Okay. Then with respect to agenda document number 08-34, I would move that we approve findings 1, 2, 3, and 5.
Now, if I understand the consensus, if I understand the consensus, though, this would stay in and our position would become known with that motion in effect. If I understand to be the case.
I take despite it that that comments. Would be your intent.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
And there would be revisions to the report to reflect.
There would be revisions in, yes. Right. There would be revisions in the final audit report to reflect where the commission stood with respect to this finding.
Mr. Chairman, I guess and this really probably is the audit division will do the revisions. It'll be more Ms. Thomas's concern than ours. But I'm not entirely clear without a vote. If there's no vote on finding for whether the commission is by this motion not accepting finding four or whether it is going to split on finding four.
If we had a separate vote on finding four,
then there would be something to, there'd be a way to characterize.
As I recall, in the previous situation we were confronted with, was the same thing arose, and we did have an understanding that the votes would be incorporated into the actually audit. There were three commissioners voted this way, three commissioners voted that way.
It's whether it's the 3-3 or something else that I guess that I'm trying to.
Well, we've already had one vote. Right. Doesn't that sort of clarify where we are on the whole thing with finding four?
I suppose in my mind not entirely, because the first vote was, as I understood, the first vote was on a motion to accept finding four with the change to reflect the funds issued to Commissioner Bowerly.
But didn't that then include the debt retirement analysis of the audit division?
That's what I was trying to nail down. If it does, that's fine.
I think it did. Try it again.
I think there's a motion on the table.
Okay. Remind me what the motion on the table was. On findings 1, 2, 3, and 5?
Yes.
To adopt those. Okay, that's the motion.
And to revise the final report to reflect the discussion at the table?
Correct.
Okay. On
with the reference to which commissioners took which position on four?
I
don't see a nod on that or not.
We've done it a number of ways.
If you want it that
years.
Way, we can certainly have it that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you want it that way, you can have it that way. So it's sort of a subset of Commissioner Weintraub's, you know, just consistent with the discussion at the table.
I think that would be consistent with the discussion at the table.
That'll mean whatever we want it to mean after we vote on this, right? That's a nice way of saying we'll figure that out later, right? That's like a commission code for, we'll get to that. All right, I'm learning.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, just for the record, maybe the thing to do, if we're not in agreement now, is to understand that, for example, if I wanted to approve four, subsequent motion could be made, could be modified, we could agree to it, and there'd be a record on that regard, I suppose.
That
procedurally
work as well.
There's a way to find some clarity here.
That would work as well.
But are we not agreeing now to just do it the way was originally brought up, and that is just mentioned the three commissioners voted this way on four or not? What do you recommend? Because it's not a pure four. We agreed on a modified four.
It would, I think I see your point that, that if the motion is, it would probably, the clearest thing would be if the motion was to approve findings 1, 2, 3, and 5, which Commissioner Peterson said, and to revise finding 4 pursuant to the table discussion and to reflect the previous vote on Commissioner Ballard's motion.
Is it? I believe that's consistent. I think that's the motion I made.
Now so I'm going to throw a curve. on finding 2.
Oh, no.
Well, finding 2 is as a result of the revised payment owed to the U.S. Treasury of $154,078. But that's the statistical kind of projection. We understand we're voting that now the commission's deciding that they owe that much money to the U.S. Treasury. What's the significance of that sentence? We decide in the whole shooting match on that issue by adopting this finding, because the first part of the finding is fine, because it talks about projection and the audit staff recommended that they do this, and I can understand that that's how we do things. But then as a result, the revised payment owed to the U.S. Treasury is $154,000, which is still a projection, as I understand it, right?
It is a projection, and it is consistent with what we have done with these findings in the past.
And consistent with the regulation.
I think probably most recent example was the Gephardt for President.
Yes.
So once we adopt this, they're going to owe $154,000 to the U.S. Treasury?
Yes.
As a disgorgement payment.
All right, so the motion's on, same motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion passes 6-0. Right, no nays.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just need some guidance on procedure now. We adopt some new language for finding number 4. Would you like us to recirculate this?
Probably recirculate.
Or, yes?
Some form. Take a 10-minute recess.